Fred Film Radio.
International Film Festivals and Awards Macau.
Fred Film Radio, I'm Matt Micucci from the second International Film Festival and Awards Macau, and I'm very pleased to be joined by director Penek Ratanaruang. And, well, you're here in Macau for two reasons. One is to present your film Samui Song, which we already have an interview with you in Venice, but I'm happy to talk about it some more here. And then, you, of course, you've selected one of the films in the Crossfire section, which we'll be talking about a little later on. But first, about Samui Song. Just to start us off, would you like to tell our listeners a little bit about your movie and a little bit about the story of your film?
Well, the Samui Song is about the life of a soap opera actress who's married to a foreigner. And her husband, the foreign husband, over the years had become kind of obsessed in this alternative religion and became very close to the leader, the cult leader. To her, to our actress mind, the husband and the cult leader plot something together for him to violate her. And so she was out for revenge. She asked a stranger she met in the parking lot. They were smoking together, you know, like people do nowadays, you know. You smoke outside the bar and you become friends, you know.
That's true.
Right, so she got to know this guy, stranger, asked him to get rid of her husband, and from that point on, things just went downhill.
Yeah.
Because the murder didn't go as planned, as a good Hitchcock plot.
Or a good film noir.
Right.
So which actually, there's two cigarettes also, you know, there's a cigarette connection between your film and the film noir.
Right, absolutely. It's in cigarette smoke is one of the most alluring cinematic device, you know, in film noirs. But yes, it's mainly a film noir, or you could call it a film noir, but it has twist after twist, you know, which is like later become something else.
Well, the story itself is very intense, and I was just wondering, where did that originate?
It originated in my head.
I don't doubt that.
I'm just one of those people who, like, you know, when you have nothing to do, I think up like these kind of things. So, well, it originates when I was shopping near my house in Bangkok, and I was in a supermarket, and I saw a very famous actress with her foreign husband, and they were shopping. So I follow them just to see what they buy, you know.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, but they don't know. I just follow. I pretend I'm, like, you know, going behind them. So I see what they buy. And then after that, okay, we pay, they go home, you know, I go home. And then a few days later, I was swimming. I started to think what their lives would be like at home, you know.
Uh-huh.
And then, yeah, then that's the story starts to form, you know, over the weeks and the months and the years after that. Uh-huh. So it took like 2 years, you know, to form the whole story. And during that 2 years, you know, while my head was spinning out this story.
This is interesting to me because, so while you were kind of forming the story in your head, do you already visualize it as a film?
Absolutely, yeah. Usually some of my films, including this one, it's just a collection of images that I have in my head, and then one day when I have enough images, I think like four or five images, I lay them out on the table, and then I just try to make some kind of story out of them. So that's how I do it.
So by the time you're writing it, then that's it. You've already formed everything. Does it ever change?
No. It changes a lot.
Right.
And during the 2 years, I was like, you got lost, you got stuck, you know, you can't go on, so you stop, you know. And then over the 2 years, when you're forming the main story, other things happen in your life. Mm. You know, like sometimes, you know, your friend die, you know. Then if that has some kind of impact to you, then it gets into the story that you're writing. You read the newspaper, and there's a scandal about some kind of alternative religion in Thailand, there's some scandalous things, then that gets into your story. So along the way, you collect things, you know, and then as a being a storyteller, you try to kind of like make sense of it, you know, like just try to make sense that. Just try to make things make sense, you know, to form an interesting story, you know.
I would presume as well that because making a film is such a big commitment, when you think about it, because it takes so long, that you also kind of want to keep yourself interested by eventually filming stuff that interests you your life in general, even outside of films.
No, but I have no problem with staying focused on one thing for many years. I have no problem with that. That's my nature. I don't have that much interest in other things, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I have no Facebook, I have no nothing. No. So I don't have any distraction, basically. I just for years and years, I just stay with my story.
Telling stories, but also an interest in cinema.
Absolutely. Because, like I said, you know, and your question was that this things change over the years, you know, along the way. Yeah, they change all the time. The moment you start scouting for locations, for example, you know, you wanted to you go and look at a house or some streets or something, and then you see something that has nothing to do with your script at all, but it looks so interesting, you want it in your film. So then that got recorded in your head, you know, and then you go home, you start changing your script, you know, your script start to change because of the location you saw. You start casting actors and actresses. The moment you start meeting them, a lot of them bring other dimensions to your script, you know, that you could never think of, you know. Then you say, oh, he walks very funny, you know, the way he walks is kind of funny, interesting. So you start incorporating that into the walk, into your script. And so, yeah, thing changes all the time.
You incorporate a process of transformation in your filmmaking.
Filmmaking is always transforming, you know. I know that, I mean, Alfred Hitchcock is a staunch believer in things don't change. You know, my script is my blueprint and I do everything exactly the way I do it, you know. I don't believe that that's true.
You think so?
I think so. I don't think, maybe he believes that's true, but I don't think, you cannot do this job and not adapting and transforming your idea or transform. It's not possible.
What I find interesting about Hitchcock as well is that he's probably the filmmaker who most theorists have written about on a psychoanalytical point of view, trying to psychoanalyze everything. And so the film has changed in other people's perceptions and people that have written about it. So the film changes even when it's not filmmaking itself, right?
But also, Hitchcock is a human being. Yeah. So, and I found out that when, even including me, you know, when you're doing interviews, when people interview you, or when you write books, or, you know, you present a certain point of view where sometime I could say this now, and then 3 years later, maybe I don't believe this anymore.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, but, and also you kind of like, when you do interviews, you try to, at least you try to say something interesting, you know. So all these things about, like, you know, actors are cows, you know, or like, you know, they have no brain, and things like that. You just tell them what to do, and, you know, so I don't believe that he believes that 100%. Yeah. I don't think so. He worked with some of the best actors and actresses, you know, of his generation, right? So, and a lot of the creativity comes from those actors as well. I don't believe that Hitchcock can tell Anthony Perkins 100% where to stand, how to walk, how to say things, what to do, like in Psycho. I don't think he does that.
Yeah,
it's not possible because you look at the performance. It's, you know, it looks very. It's like very spontaneous, you know. So it's
Absolutely. I was a picture as well. I don't know if you're familiar with I Confess, and there was a wonderful by Hitchcock with Montgomery Clift.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful observation that it's a wonderful observation by François Truffaut in that film that he always remembered walking and an endless movement. This character just walks the whole film, the entire film. And I always wondered then, but like, if there's so much movement in it, how can you control all that movement?
Right,
so,
exactly.
Just, it just came in my head.
Exactly.
But going back, it was a very interesting conversation. And but I guess the same thing then is for the way in which you perceive art. So maybe you used to like things that you don't like anymore, but you were really passionate about it, and you could have really, you know, fought for the belief, other people, changing other people's beliefs that maybe they didn't like the movie or didn't like that or art form, and now you don't like it anymore. Is that true? Your perception of some art form.
Yeah. I'm the other way around. Oh, yeah. Like with my own movies, when I was younger, I used to, after I made maybe like 4 or 5 films, I cannot watch my own films. Once it's done, it's torture. I watch them and they become like embarrassment to me. Like, it doesn't matter what people say, how good this one is. I watch it, you only see mistakes. You only see like, oh, why did I do that? You know, that's horrible. You know, the cut is too short, that cut is too long. You know, oh God, why did he say that? You know, look at the way he says it, it's so bad. So you only see these mistakes, and it used to be very embarrassed to have to watch my own films, you know, and to the point where it became almost like a phobia for me to have to sit and watch my own films. Yeah. So, but now that I'm older, I go back and have to watch those films that used to embarrass me a lot, you know. Now I don't feel embarrassed anymore. Right. Like, they are what they are.
Yes.
And that has to do with age, I think. And like, when you become a bit older, you start to accept your own limitations.
Yeah.
You start to accept your own mistakes, you know, whatever it is. But when I was younger, I used to like, oh, I can't stand this. I cannot stand this. You know, it has to be like this, you know. But now I'm much more kind of relaxed about, you know, these kind of things, you know. So it's not like I used to like something and now I hate it. It's more like I used to hate something and now I'm okay with it, you know.
But your films are always talked about very well. So maybe, what you were saying there is interesting, because again, maybe you get used to praise as well, or no?
No, I of course I like praise, you know. Right. But when people praise my films, I look at them differently. Once I finish editing the film, I know exactly, I mean, not exactly, I know more or less how well I've done with this one. Mm-hmm. I don't need to read reviews. I don't need 5 people to tell me, this is good, this is bad, you know. I know, like, once I finish the film, once I give it up to the producer, I know, okay, this one I did quite well. This one I'm really proud of. It's really, really quite well, you know. This one is pretty not so good. It's not so good. Luckily, I haven't done, like, really, really embarrassing job. Like, I have not yet, you know. Even the ones that I don't like the most are still okay, you know, in this terms of, like, standard, you know. But, so I have my own, like, I have my own particular challenge that I have to meet and things like that, you know, for every film that I do. So it doesn't matter what people say about the films. It's good, you know, if they say good things, I love it, you know, it's good, you know. And they say a bad thing, okay, you get hurt a little bit. But all that quickly goes away in, like, 1 hour, you know. The bad comment or the good comment quickly go away overnight, you know. But what stays with you is how you feel about your effort, you know. Like, that stays.
Yeah.
If it's not so good, you know, then it stays.
You know, think about, like, if someone comes up to you and says, your film was wonderful, and if someone else comes up to you and says, I hated your film. Is it, there's passion in both statements. Do you look at what they both say? Like, do you look at the person that didn't like the movie and go, like, well, that makes me feel terrible? Or do you look at the person that said, well, that movie was great and it makes you feel great? Or do you see the passion in both statements and go, like, well, at least it made them feel something?
Like I said, usually, once I finish my films, I usually know how well I've done. Like, how badly I've done, you know. I kind of know I have, like, it's around this area. So when someone come and say that this film is really a piece of shit, you know, I really hated it, and you know that it's not really a piece of shit, then you know that he exaggerates, he or she exaggerates, you know, for whatever reason you don't know. Or when you think you haven't done not so well, you know, and someone say, "Panic, that's wonderful." I think you know that he or she is like overpraising.
Right.
So I know that. I don't. So in a way, what you said about the two statements of the two extremes, you know, that with equal passions, I usually don't react to those kind of things. Okay, if someone say your film is wonderful, the most you can say is thank you, you know. Right? Like, thank you. I'm glad you enjoy it, you know. So, if someone's coming to you and say, you know, I hate your film, then I say, you know, what can you say? I apologize, you know. I'm sorry. Wow. But usually when people hate your film, they don't come and say it.
Well, I was wondering whether that ever happened or does that happen much?
No, it never happened because, and I'm one of those people when I meet people and when they say this, I saw your film, Panek, you know, if they say that, I never ask,
yeah.
Did you like it? You know why? Because if they say, oh, Panek, I saw your film, it means they didn't like it. Because, okay, maybe they didn't hate it, but it's kind of like, for them, it's so-so.
Right.
Because when somebody likes my film, they really love it, they said, Panek,
yeah.
I saw the film, it was great. People are enthusiastic to express the positive things, but with the negative things, they hold back.
Right. So a positive comment would start off with like, oh, it was unbelievable.
They would come straight at, exactly, they would come straight at you. And I have had, like, you know, both kind of reactions, you know, to the films. You know, some of the films, you know, people say, Panic, that was wonderful, you know. It was great, you know, super, you know. And then in some films, say, hey, Panic, I saw your film, you know.
Well, I'm really enjoying this conversation, and I know we're going a little over time. But why don't we just tie that together with the film that you chose to show at this at this festival, because it's a great section, actually. Crossfire, there are so many great films.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And you picked Kind Hearts and Coronets, the classic Ealing Studios film. Why did you pick this film?
Well, what can I say? I can't say enough good things about that film. It's a wonderful film. You know, it's made before none of us were born. But you look at it now, and it's still so audacious. It's so modern, and it's, for me, it's the black comedy of the highest order. There was nothing extra, nothing more, and nothing less about it. It's just right. It's just like almost like a perfect dish for me. And okay, when people think about that film, of course, people who've seen the film, you know, they think about that film and they always talk about Alec Guinness, who played 8 roles.
Yeah.
8 different roles of the Descoigne families, right? Even including the woman, you know, and that was like the most thing that people talk about. But for me, okay, that was great. But for me, the greatest thing about that film is the voiceover narration of Dennis Price.
Yeah,
his voiceover narration that delivers through the entire film. It's so unforgettable for me. It's kind of cold, it's kind of calm, and it has some, you can feel that he's amused to be telling these stories, and at the same time, he has some kind of contempt for this family that did wrongs to his mother. And that, I think, that voiceover stays with me from the first day I saw that film until today. You know, and I've seen that film maybe like 10 times, you know.
Right.
But the reason I picked, of course, being one of the greatest films of all time in the world for me, one of my favorite films, also because I've never seen this film on a big screen.
Yes.
I've only seen it on, you know, on TV and the computers. So I pick it so that I can see it with the audience here on the big screen.
That's amazing.
And it was wonderful, and it was wonderful last night. You know, people were really enjoying it, and yeah. So.
Well, that's great. Well, I have one more question on this film, actually. Do you remember the first time you saw it? When did you see it?
It has to be nearly 20 years ago, I'm sure. Nearly 20 years ago. And it was given to me on a VHS cassette, yeah, from a friend who... I think these people, they came to shoot a TV commercial with me. And they are like creatives. They work in advertising agency. And I think the guy is British. His name is Jeff or something. So we were shooting together for like 5 days. You know, so every day we get to know each other more and more. And then, you know, we talked about, he is very passionate about film. And he said, do you know this film? And I said, no, I've never heard of it, you know. And yeah, he sent me a cassette one day of this film, you know, Kind Hearts and Coronets, and on a VHS, and I watched it, and it was like, it really, it became immediately, you know, one of my favorites. Yeah.
That's great. It was great talking to you. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
It's been amazing. And this is Fred Film Radio, the Festival Insider.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on fred.fm and smartphone apps.